So Pat is teaching, so he couldn't come, and because of that, the presentation will be not as lively as it would be if he were here. I want to also apologize to everybody because the slides, especially to Rody, because we sent the slides only yesterday to him, and there is not much of a correlation between what's in the paper and what's in the slides, but I'm sure he'll have much more to complain about now with what we came up with. So I hope you guys like. Okay, so talk a little bit about the Brazilian hyperinflation. The main characteristics are that it lasted around a decade. I'm gonna be more specific about how I define the hyperinflation, because it clearly is not Kagan's definition, because according to Kagan's definition, there was only 3 months of hyperinflation in Brazil in the 90s. Why did it last so long? I'm gonna go through that again. Basically because there was a lot of indexation, and that made life with the hyperinflation possible without a collapse in output, okay? We had 5 failed attempts to stabilize before the Real Plan of July 94. And the final one was successful, and this year is the 20th birthday of the Real Plan. And so far, we've been able to get to keep inflation low, okay? The main issue, the main theme of this presentation is the very tight link between inflation and money growth, okay? So that's basically what I'll be repeating a lot during this presentation. And the idea is that you assume what is now a standard fiscal-driven stabilization, and that's what is in the end of 4 big inflations, you would assume that the money printing ends when the large, credible fiscal adjustment is made. And we tried a lot to make this work, and I'll talk about that at the end if I have time. But eventually, even Pat had to give up because the Brazilian numbers don't match that at all. And so it's not the crazy Brazilian who's saying it, but it's Pat that came with this, okay? So what I'm gonna show you is that the money hyperprinting stopped in the Real Plan, okay? But immediately after, or during, then the fiscal situation deteriorated a lot, and debt go up really, really fast, okay? So in terms of fiscal stance, I'll concentrate on the operational deficit that is defined as the primary, which is the one without interest payments, plus the real interest on debt. And the reason you do that, because the nominal is not a good indicator of the fiscal stance during hyperinflation, okay? So only 5 years after the stabilization, so only 99, after another crisis when we float the currency, did the fiscal stance actually improve, okay? So the punchline we have is that while fiscal stance eventually improved, there is no deliberate and drastic, and the quotes are because I take this from the end of 4 big inflation, fiscal measures associated with the end of the Brazilian hyperinflation, at least not at the time. Okay, so your question is that link more like a pro-Friedman explanation of inflation and not the one that Sargent and Wallace favors, and in one of the cases, the fiscal dominant one in the unpleasant monetarist arithmetic paper? What I'm gonna show you, and then I'll repeat again, I already said once, but I'm gonna show you more and more, is that the stabilization displays a very tight link between money printing and inflation. One could say this sort of tautological, but what is not is the fiscal deterioration that happens after the plan and did not derail the stabilization. I think this is quite interesting, okay? So after this brief introduction, I'm gonna talk about the history of the Brazilian hyperinflation. I'm gonna describe the 5 failed stabilization attempts. Then I'll talk about the Real Plan and why did it work. And basically the answer will be because they basically were able to cut money growth, but they did not cut the deficits. And the theme will be the tight contemporaneous correlation between money and inflation, okay? Okay, So let me start with the hyperinflation history. Okay, this is the graph that is in the end of four big inflations. So I did it for Brazil in logs, okay? And funny that I just noticed here, but I wasn't able to correct. This is the first plan. It's called the Cruzado plan. But my array did that. My array is 20 years old. So he wrote Cruzeiro, which was the name of the one of the old currencies, which is a mistake that, of course, very natural, but not for somebody of my age that lived through that. So that basically would never make such a mistake. So this is the Cruzado plan of February 86. That's probably when Saki was being born, but I was almost going to Stanford at that time. Then you have the Plesser plan, the Summer plan, the Collor 1 plan, and the Collor 2 plan, and then finally you have the Real when you are able to stabilize prices, okay? In terms of inflation, these are the inflation rates in monthly terms, okay? Pat wanted to put it in annual, but in annual you don't see anything because there is a spike there, 80% when you annualize that, and then you don't see anything. And then if you put in logs, you get sort of the same picture. So basically that's why, and you see that after the Real plan, you were able to stabilize, okay? If you compare that, then the so-called classic hyperinflations, four of which are reviewed in Tom's paper, and I have some of them right there, the ones after World War I and World War II, okay? And you see that they are very fast. They usually last a little over a year. Prices increase a lot. Then you have very tight correlation between inflation and money growth. Money growth always grows less than inflation because real money demand goes down. If you put the Brazil here, this is how Brazil would fit. So basically prices go up by a factor similar to Germany, but instead of 1 year and a few months, it lasts 11 years. Okay, so how did I decide January 1983? That's basically when we went up over 200% per year. It's not hyperinflation by Kagan's definition, but as I said, if I stick to Kagan's definition, I'm going to have like only 3 months in my sample, and that's not what I want to explain. Why did Brazilian hyperinflation last so long? Basically, indexation ensures that even during hyperinflation, you don't have a collapse of GDP growth, okay? So here I have the GDP growth, that scale here, okay? So 0% is here, okay? And here I have inflation, that scale here, okay? So that's annual inflation. And what I call the Brazilian hyperinflation start more or less here and ends in July 94, okay? So basically you see that when inflation goes up, growth comes down, but it's not a collapse. And while it's going up here, and while before 92, 94, growth is going up, actually. So there's no real collapse of GDP, okay? And after that, that's the same picture just until today. You can't see inflation, but you see the growth. So there is some correlation here, to be sure, but the correlation in this part here is positive, so. And that's mainly because of indexation. So indexation was something that was perfected a lot in Brazil since the 60s. And the idea was to isolate the real economy from inflation. During the late 60s, Milton Friedman visited Brazil. And that was a quote that I took from a Simonsen's book that he said that indexation was the second best to price stability. As we know, in retrospect, that indexation made life with inflation easier, but also made it much more difficult to fight inflation, including politically, because, of course, people didn't feel that much the evils of inflation. So it took many, many years to get a political coalition that would gain from conquering hyperinflation. Other issues that were talked here that make Brazil different. So why didn't Brazil endogenously dollarize? And by dollarize here, I meant what Fernando said this morning, the fact that you had deposits in dollars and people basically could pay anything in with dollars without bothering with large discounts in exchange rate. That never happened in Brazil. By the way, since the 30s, it's illegal in Brazil for the banks to issue deposits in dollars. Okay, so that's one of the reasons why our derivatives, currency derivatives market is so powerful, because basically people do everything they would otherwise do in the spot markets, they do in the derivatives, because the legislation of the 30s, of course, didn't cover derivatives. So basically, that's what happened. But that was never the case in Brazil, that you could pay anything in the streets with dollars, as what was possible in Argentina, Bolivia, and Peru. Okay, so basically, what kept dollarization in that sense at bay was that banks actually issued deposits that offered some inflation protection. Okay, these were took different formats for during many years. They were called different names, but basically they were deposits that somehow they protect the depositors from inflation. Okay, the way it was done was that the banks issue those deposits and they bought government securities. And those government securities, also it varied a lot. They were either indexed directly to inflation or they were very short maturity so that they did not bear too much interest rate risk. Okay? So the idea was that Brazil avoided this dollarization by engineering this domestic substitute to its own currency. So we like to call it the domestic currency substitute. So there was this formula, and what they used to say at the time was that Brazil had replaced social conflict with a mathematical formula. So basically that we had resolved. It started once a year, yes. Okay, and because of inflation was accelerating, there was a compression, a huge compression in terms of wages. So that was very good for the profits. So there was a lot of savings in Brazil and a lot of investment during the military years and what we call arrocho salarial, was the lowering of the wages, was an important factor to this increase in corporate savings. Okay, and with inflation, then that started happening once every twice a year, and I think that just before the Cruzado plan, if I'm not mistaken, it was already once a month. So every month you'd get a no, it was not once a month, because that was a problem. It became it's really interesting, because in like 79 the inflation rate was 40 when Simonsen leaves the government, and then Delfim Neto comes in with his slogan was, I'm going to fight inflation not lowering demand but increasing supply, and he lowers the interest rate and then inflation, and he also does he changes the wage indexation from annually to biannually, twice a year. And it's funny, because the inflation raises from 40 to 200, which is precisely the amount that you need to keep the real wage constant. So it's really, really funny. 3 years, you have the inflation necessary to put the wages, the real wage. Yeah, okay. So talk about the Tanzi effect. Brazil, in this perfecting this indexation mechanism, we, of course, the government was very keen in indexing its own revenues. So basically, when you're going to pay taxes in Brazil, you don't pay in nominal terms, right? The day the taxes are computed, you compute how many, let's say, the equivalent of dollars would that tax be, and when you go to the bank, they would compute that in nominal terms and you would pay that. So we had a unit of account, probably the Chilean paper, we'll talk about a similar thing that they have there, they have until this day. It's called UF, in Brazil it's called UFIR, and basically that's something that would go up with inflation. So that was meant to keep the real value of taxes unaltered between the time where you compute the taxes and when you pay. So in Brazil, so this part of the Oliveira, Tanzi, Bresciani, Turroni effect didn't work, because taxes were very well indexed. And on the other hand, after a certain in the 90s, I'll talk about it later, but since you asked, I'll answer it now. The government start postponing expenditure. So for example, and the budget would say, let's build this bridge. It's 3 million reais. That was the amount budget in January of that year. But then instead of disbursing the 3 million in January, you would disburse in December, where of course the 3 million was much lower. Of course, you wouldn't have money enough to build the bridge. So Brazil at the time was full of half bridges and half infrastructure, but at least you would contain the, you'd use that to balance the budget. So the belief, and that's one of the things we are trying to document, but it's hard to do. We only have two data points, is that the Oliveira-Tanzi effect in Brazil worked the other way around, because you had almost perfect indexation of revenues, and the expenditures, you could actually erode the real value of the expenditures by postponing those, okay? So there is a guy who did his master's dissertation, and he claims that for 1990 and 1991, this effect was like 40%. So he computed the value of the budget in dollars, and what was actually disbursed was equivalent to 40%, 60% of the originally planned budget. Okay, so we are trying to do something with that. We haven't done that yet. Okay. All right, so let me go back now to the banks. So basically, how banks were able to provide these index deposits. Basically, you'd put your money there, the banks would buy bonds. Okay, and those bonds were, as I said, they would usually be very short term or indexed to inflation. The problem with that is that these banks were very leveraged. Okay, and if the central bank decided, for example, say, well, I want to end the inflation today, I'm going to stop print money, basically the real rate would shoot up because everybody would go there and try to get deposits to do the payments, everything was indexed, right? So there would be this big demand, the nominal demand for money would keep growing, and the banks would have somehow to supply that. But of course, the only guy who can supply reserves in the open market is the central bank, and the central bank, we just assumed it's not going to do that. So what would have happened, and actually happens a few times, when the central bank was forced to raise interest rates very, very sharply, that banks would go bankrupt. So basically, the monetary policy during hyperinflation was basically passive monetary policy. And by passive, I mean keeping a real interest rate positive, low, and more or less constant, okay? So basically they would say, what's the inflation rate for next month? 14%. Okay, then the nominal interest rate for next month will be 14.5. And of course, when inflation gets very volatile, that's not always perfect, but that's more or less what basically they did. So the point I wanna make it here, is that the central bank, although sometimes it tried to do some sort of active monetary policy, and by active I mean raising real interest rate, couldn't do it alone, okay? So in order to be able to stop printing money as it eventually did, it had to resort to some other means of stopping this increase in nominal money demand. And the success, there were price freezes and et cetera, but the successful one was this thing called real unit of value, and I'll talk a little bit about that later on, okay? So let me now move to the inflation history. I'll talk a little bit about the plans. So I'm from 80 to 85, and I'll show the statistics for the period. We have this movement that inflation is going up, 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 up. And then 85, 94, we have the five failed plans, the Cruzado of 86, the Bresser of 87, the summer of 89, the color one of 90, and the color two of 92. There are others that I decide not to call plans, but I can list up to eight attempts there, okay? And finally, 94, we have the successful one, the Real Plan, okay? I was commenting that the name is really unfortunate because now we have to talk about the nominal real rate and the real rate So sometimes it's very, very, very confusing. Okay. All right, so this is a picture that will show up here many times. This is monthly inflation, okay? So here you see that in 83, it breached the 10%, which is more or less when it goes above 200% per year. Then you have the first attempt, comes down, second attempt, comes down, goes up, comes down, goes up, comes down, goes up, and finally, after the Real Plan, it stayed down for the last 20 years, okay? So five, Cruzado, Bresser, Summer, Collar 1, Collar 2, and the Real. So let me talk a little bit about them. So these are all ambitious plans, but all failed. And the main weakness, and Pat was very keen that I put this thing here, because they continued printing money. Well, the fiscal stance in many of them were not great either, but the emphasis is that money printing come back big time, okay? So let's make some details of those, okay? So the Cruzado plan, so because of political reason, there was wages were raised just at the beginning of the plan. The minimum wage was raised by 8%, and they kept this trigger mechanism that if inflation went up over 20%, then all wages would be raised automatically, and that happened actually at the end of the year. So that was everything was going very bad at the time, but when that was triggered, then basically that was the big problem. So the anastasy part was that they pegged the exchange rate to the dollar, okay? Well, they did change the currency, they cut zeros. There is this forced interest rate conversion, basically, because they want to automatically change all nominal interest rates into real, because the real rate, now that inflation was going to be zero, so they had a mechanism for that. I'm not going to go into that, but it's in the presentation. There was an important fiscal thing they did, was that the Brazilian Banco do Brasil, which is a commercial bank, had this automatic credit line with the Brazilian Central Bank, and that finished in that plan. So that was really important. Unfortunately, that's coming back. I can talk about that later. But there's no major change in fiscal policy. And in 10 months, we are back to double-digit monthly inflation, and the wage adjustment was triggered, okay? So then in 10 months, it was gone. Then 87, then in 87, July, we have another plan called the Bresser plan. Froze prices, adjusted weighted based on the average of the three previous months. The idea was to make some sort of a average real wage constant, okay? He raised the interest rate. The idea was to keep the nominal deficit to 3.7%, but since inflation went up again, the nominal deficit is nominal expenditures minus nominal revenues. If you take out the so-called inflation correction of the debt, which is basically pi times the previous debt, then you have the operational debt that is the primary, which is the fiscal deficit without interest rate revenues and payments, plus the real rate. Okay, so I have at the very end, I'm going to show you how these pictures are. But basically, the idea is that in a hyperinflation, if you have a very tough fiscal stance, just because inflation is high, and if you have say for example 30% debt to GDP ratio, and you have 100% inflation, right? Even if you don't spend anything above what you get, your in nominal terms, this thing is going to double. Okay, so then we have the new constitution. Okay. In 88, and look at the date, 88. That's before the fall of the Berlin Wall, okay? So although we are very happy to return to democracy in 85, for example, if you think about that in this respect, the Chileans, quote unquote, had a little more luck, because then they did the same thing after the Berlin Wall. And I'm not saying that I like the dictatorship, but our constitution basically says that the state has to provide everything for everybody, no matter the cost, okay? So it became really, really a big problem, and we are a federation. And so a lot of revenue went to the states and municipalities without the the obligation of providing the services that somehow stayed with the federal level. So I can talk about the political effects of that, but basically that was very bad. Okay, so that increased expenditures and transfers from the central government to state and municipalities. We have the reduction of the work week from 48 to 44 hours. Okay, we increased firing costs and overtime compensation. Everything is in the Constitution. Okay, so if you need to undo something like that, you need 60% of both houses to vote. So very, very difficult to do. Okay, if you look, the problems that Lula is facing with the people that went to jail were to approve some good thing, which was the change for Social Security. So he had to resort more or less what in that movie about Lincoln to approve the 13th Amendment. So basically that's what Lula did. He bought votes around and was able to approve something like that, but very difficult to do. And there are a lot of earmarked revenues. You have to give this percentage to education, this percentage to health, this percent. So could be. That's the big problem. Okay. Wow. Let me run. Okay. So that turned the fiscal side much more difficult than before. Okay. So let me run. So then we have the couple of color plans. This is the first democratically elected president that was ousted less than 2 years after because of corruption. So he froze prices and wages. There was a new currency, the Cruzeiro. Then there is this thing that he did, which is probably the biggest violence ever. Overnight, when the day he took office, all financial assets in the country, all were frozen. Okay, so and you had right to get something like I don't know what was at the time, but it was not much above $1,000. Okay, everything. So people committed suicide about because of that. Some people died because they had surgery and they had to pay, but they didn't have access to their financial assets. It was a big mess. So there was an ambitious fiscal plan. Privatizations started there. That was good. Some succeeded. And other fiscal reforms were short-lived. Open up the economy. Maybe that's the best thing that happened in this plan. Oh, actually, that was the second one. Okay. Then in 91, he started again. Froze prices, fixed exchange rate. Open up the economy. That was really, really important. Okay. And but many of the attempts to reduce expenditures were short-lived because basically people went to court and got reinstated, so it didn't quite work. What they call the mecamola, how do you say, the spring effect, right? You compress and it comes back. Okay, but privatization and the opening up of the economy are probably the good things from this period. So let me move to the Real Plan. Why did it work? Okay, well, if you're going to see, because it stopped printing money, because the fiscal side did not improve a lot. In fact, fiscal policy got worse during the first 5 years of the plan. Okay, let me move to show you the picture of, okay. So here I have the operational deficit, which is the primary plus the real expenditures, okay? So if it's positive, it's a deficit. If it's negative, it's a surplus. These are the blue bars, okay? The red bars are seniorage, okay? This seniorage is one seniorage that's computed month by month to avoid the mistakes, because there's a lot of remonetization, as you saw in the thing. So so the first, we have some data before, but it's not very good. The good data starts in 85. So if you take the 5 years from 85 to 89, the average seniorage is 3.7% of GDP per year, okay? While the average operational deficit is 5.1, so pretty high. When you get into the 90s, okay, then you have these two surpluses here, okay. Seniorage goes up to 3.9% of GDP, and the primary, the operational deficit goes down to zero on average. So that's before the plan, okay. So there was some adjustment that was done, as badly as it's possible, But that was before the plan. The plan is 94. Okay? That's the real plan here. And then you look immediately after the plan, from 95 to 99, what happens? Then seniorage goes down to 0.7% of GDP in a normal, more or less in a normal economy. Not as Tim wants, but it's still sort of normal. But the operational deficit goes up to 3.9. So that's the opposite to what the fiscal story would tell you. That, the fiscal was good in 94, but in 95, after that, and what picked up? Of course, that was the debt. So here you can see one of the effects. So you have here the foreign debt are the red bars, and the domestic debt is the blue bars. So you see that the foreign debt is going down here, and part of that is the effect of the Brady plan. Okay, so but if you look what happened after, then the debt to GDP goes up from 30% up to 60% of GDP. So after the plan, there was no fiscal adjustment. If you compare, except for the most recent period when interest rates came down a lot, and that's what made the operational deficit come down so much in the most recent period, you see that the fiscal stance that was in the 5 years previous to the plan was probably better than the one that we have with low inflation. The difficulty that we had fitting a fiscal story into that. Okay, we tried hard. I'm going to show you that we tried really hard, but we couldn't do it. Okay, so basically, now I have money growth, which is the blue, and annual inflation being the red. And you see that clearly both came down after the plan, as it necessarily would happen. There is some remonetization here, before you ask me. So this blue bar here is not only the inflation, because the plan was July 1st. So there was some effect there. But what we want to emphasize here is that basically what really happened was they stopped printing money. But the fiscal side, what picked up there was the debt. Okay. All right, so conclusion. Okay. So in the Brazilian hyperinflation experience, the link between inflation and therefore seniorage and money growth is a contemporaneous one. It's not one that depends on what people expect, etc. It's very, very. Fiscal improvements in the early 90s did not help on the inflation front. Okay, so until the 94, the fiscal side had improved, but inflation kept going up. Okay, and after the plan, we had a marked deterioration in fiscal stance. Okay. So we think that this is an evidence that the Friedman-like monetary dominant regime fits, and monetary dominant, I mean, one of the regimes that is in Sargent and Wallace, because they talk about monetary money dominance and fiscal dominance. Okay, so we see that as more of an evidence of money dominance than fiscal dominance. Okay, what I was going to show was basically some calculations we've done. They are in the paper, trying to compute how much seniorage you would need given certain hypotheses you made and some hypothesis about the money demand function, et cetera. And the result basically was that after the plan, with the fiscal numbers that we had, you needed at least as much seniorage as you need before the plan. And that was, it was debt that picked up the tab. Okay, so we didn't see that as an evidence that would corroborate the fiscal dominant view, but the monetary dominant view. It still begs the question why people were being willing to finance the real plan and not the other ones, but that's something that we still have to research. Thank you.
I guess I'm going to follow the venerable tradition initiated by Fernando Alvarez, and I'm going to think of this as a referee report. And I apologize because my report was prepared before I got the slides, so it probably won't match very well with the talk, but I'll try to make a couple of adjustments. As Marcio described the paper, it's a very interesting account of different stabilization plans in Brazil over the last 20, 40 years, it's work in progress. So, you know, there are a few graphs, there are no tables, and there's an accounting exercise. And there's a question, which I think is somehow the question that you asked in the end, although didn't have time to show your calculations, is how much of the inflationary experience can be attributed to fiscal policy, sort of especially after the Real plan. And the version that I had of the paper promised to have some other stuff, which, you know, he delivered. So let me start with a good part of the referee report, which is a wish list. What would have been nice to see, or what will probably be interesting to see in the final version of the paper? Well, I want a lot of data. I want data on expenditures, I want data on prices, I want data on the fiscal situation. Monetary policy has different forms, and in particular, when one thinks hard about the demand for money, I think that in Brazil, there have been times in which the part of the government policy was to artificially change the demand for money, including required reserves. So sometimes we're 100% of demand deposits. It's useful to, you know, in some sense, describe all those institutional details. And also, and I'll come back to this, the structure of the debt, which you guys point out, has changed over time. I think the details about the debt structure matter. I'll try to make that point later. Part of my wish list includes knowing a little bit about the structure of taxes. Were they taxing capital? Were they taxing consumption? Were they taxing labor? And maybe if there are any cyclical properties of expenditures and tax revenues. The accounting exercise that is sort of described in the paper is fairly rich in some sense. It includes different types of bonds. There's room for regular nominal bonds, for index bonds, for bonds that are indexed to the nominal exchange rate. And at least the calculations that I saw in terms of whether can we think of fiscal decisions driving inflation, I don't know if I'm saying it the right way, it kind of reverts back to the very standard government budget constraint. So this is the present discounted value of the government budget constraint in steady state, right? Seniorage is gotta be a function of the deficit and real interest payments. And I want to emphasize, all the theory requires, and maybe I should come back to this, is that the present discounted value be enough to support low seniorage, not the period by period. So it seems like if one wants to think of whether this is a good way of thinking about inflation or a bad way of thinking about inflation, the government budget constraint is an identity. It's not a theory that we need to test. The present discounted value is going to be equal to some sense to seniorage if you will measure things correctly. The question, it seems like the question that was being asked is whether contemporaneously we need the adjustment or whether the adjustment can occur 4 years into the future. That I don't think the government budget constraint is going to help answer that question. Why some plan is credible and another is not is an interesting question, but has very little to do with this. I just want to even point out that even if one takes this view, and I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Marcio, but you guys take some numbers for deficit and the average debt and the real interest rate and the growth rate, and you end up with using different assumptions about the demand for money, you end up with an estimate of inflation of about 130%. Is that right? And during the Real plan, so that's a puzzle. You know, this should be 130, and it's about 6 on average, right? But you showed a picture that shows that in the first few years, there was an increase in the debt GDP ratio, right? So let me propose a different plan that, for reasons that I don't understand, is believed by everyone. I'm not going to make any fiscal adjustment for 4 years. I'm going to let the debt GDP ratio go up from 30 to 60%, and then I'm going to stabilize. If I do that, and I use exactly the same calculation that gives you 130%, but instead of using 45%, I use 60% as my debt GDP ratio. And these are numbers about real interest rates and growth rates. I took this, the quantity theory, exactly the same version. Then I end up with an estimate, I end up with an estimate of the nominal, of the inflation rate of about 7%, which doesn't look too bad. It was 6.6 over this period. So for such a wimpy theory of the demand for money, it doesn't do too badly. Again, the puzzle is, how did it go from 30% to 60% from 94 to 2000, and people did not started, you know, increasing prices? That's a real puzzle. But after that, I think it's okay. Let me go back to this tight relationship between money and inflation. I think this is a puzzle, personally. This is the 1995. I didn't want to include 1994 because of the half year, right? And maybe 1995 is not still part of the adjustment. Let me show you what happens when you graph this. This is the rate of growth of the monetary base. Sometimes it's 30%. Prices are like 4%. I would not call this a stable demand for money. I mean, there's something going on here. And clearly, when you put those numbers next to the annual inflation rates, they look like they're all zero. But they're not zero, and they're not zero by a lot. 30% increase in the monetary base in a year is a lot of change. I have no answer for this. Let me make a couple of sort of picky referee report comments. One is that the term structure of the debt may matter when one ends up computing nominal interest rates and real interest rates. And if you think about a two-period bond that pays a coupon in the first period equal to zeta m and a coupon m in the second period and returns principal, and I'm forcing, if I is the nominal interest rate, then I'm forcing these two bonds to sell at par, you know, one-period bond, then it turns out that if I were to think of just one interest rate, I would be making a mistake if I don't account for whether zeta is equal to one or not, if the structure of the coupons matters. And this has to do with the fact that interest payments are in part repayment of principal, right? And so in particular, you end up overestimating the real cost of debt depending on whether you ignore or not the structure of debt. I took this from the World Bank. It could well be wrong, but I'd say that this is something to think about. Real interest rates came down a lot in Brazil. These are the real interest rate on treasury bonds. So I think that this is something to think about. Finally, and this is an issue that actually Tom has thought about quite a bit, I'm a little concerned about how to compute interest payments. The idea of adding up coupons and dividing by the nominal value of the debt, that doesn't really give you the right answer depending on the term structure. So here's an example. I did that. I just added these coupons. I divided by nominal debt. And it turns out that even though the nominal interest rate is 15%, and I know these bonds pay 15% because I'm imposing that they sell at par, then when I do that calculation, depending on what I assume about the structure of coupons, so this is a bond that pays a small coupon and a large coupon at the end, so it's not smooth, then I end up estimating 19%. So I think there are some corrections that need to be made. Finally, given the presentation, I'll say a couple more things. I was thinking about a very simple model. I'll call it a semi-partial equilibrium model in which consumption grows at a rate G, and there's some stochastic component. Then the log of prices changes at the rate of expected inflation. That's pi t. And pi t is kind of a mean reverting process. Thinking about the real plan. And I'm assuming in this economy there's constant relative risk aversion and a discount factor. Then there are some pretty standard results. If I were to look at Brazil's indexed debt, then the real return, again, I'm assuming that markets work very well, is the standard option, right? It's the discount rate plus the growth rate, and there's an adjustment for variability. However, if I were to look at the return on the nominal bond, using this rate to price this bond would be wrong. So the return on the nominal bond is this object plus the inflation rate. And this has to do with the covariance. I mean, the only reason why this is not equal to R star is because potentially there's a variance in the unexpected inflation component, and the covariance between consumption and unexpected inflation could be negative. So if you have a negative covariance, then it turns out that the relationship is not even monotone. So again, thinking about calculating interest rates and trying to use that government budget constraint to figure out what the fiscal cost of different types of debt is. Let me make a couple more comments about the presentation. So Marcio raised another puzzle, which I think is very interesting. He said that hyperinflation had no real effects. Why stopping it? I mean, it showed us a picture that said, you know, there aren't big effects here. So who cares? There are other countries in which there has been extensive indexation, and hyperinflation did not last that long. And the same type of indexation as in Brazil, right? When I was going to school, people studying accounting had to learn how to adjust for inflation, all the accounting balances so that taxes would be paid, blah, blah, blah. Same as in Brazil. Hyperinflation in Argentina didn't last very long. Okay. So I'm not sure that indexation is the ultimate reason why high inflation lasted for that long. And I think the second puzzle, which I think is interesting and that Marcio raised, is So let me describe some of these plans. I think I'm going to bore some of you because I said this. Suppose that I were to announce that I'm going to run an ultra marathon tomorrow, or let's say next month. And somebody asked me, so are you training? I said, nope. I'm not going to do anything. I'm just going to run an ultra marathon next month. But I'm going to start eating the way ultra marathoners eat. So two things are going to happen. First, I'm going to start putting a lot of weight, and at some point, I have to stop. And second, in this crowd, nobody would believe me. So one of the puzzles is the color plan sounded just like my plan, and no one believed it. The real plan in real time sounded just like my plan, but somehow people believed it. Or at least in realization, that's what happened. I think it's a real puzzle. What accounts for the differences in outcomes, even though in the short run, there were no major adjustments associated with the real plan? On the other hand, there were adjustments, right? The primary surplus was about 3.5% over 15 years. So I enjoyed the paper and looking forward to what's coming.
Sorry, I'm just wondering, all these plans in the end end up fixing the nominal exchange rate, right? They pay the exchange rate, they nominal exchange rate. And they have basically, so, you know, so I guess with the repair question, you pay the exchange rate, how can you run out of reserves or the ability to borrow from the reserves? That's another way to state it. Mm-hmm. In practice, that's a way you will end up, that you will have to basically not being able to borrow to replenish your reserves or just plainly run out of reserves and have a capital flat. So just to think that the way you will see them and imagine all of these, they end up that way. You know, at some point the central bank says, well, we can't really convert it or we change it. So if that's the case, it would be nice to document it. Just as a
there's Joe, so the student of Pablo, this is Joe Yoshino from Brazil, who wrote this paper, and he had both a theoretical model and he had a bunch of data. The striking data were that when Brazil went into big inflation in the 80s, the quote unquote value added in the banking sector went up by 2 or 3 times. It was much bigger than other countries that weren't, and they were basically running the transit. They were helping people like you, you know, middle class people avoid inflation tax because someone was paying inflation tax. Mm-hmm. And it's those guys in Bahia and so on that didn't have checking accounts. there was social waste, and there's also a lot of guys who get hurt.
Subsequently, Rao and Aiden, they wrote a paper in the JP on the same day.
We really gave us an example of a policy that is consistent with having deficit for a few years. Whether the reason why that was credible or not, you see. But what I find really puzzling is the fact that the guys between 90 and 94, they actually were running surpluses on average, and they were still printing money. They didn't need to. So what happened? Yeah, they were, so if we take the magical train, and then basically probably telling us, okay, you're not printing money, you're running deficit, then you're increasing the debt. But these guys were running surpluses and were printing money. So what were they paying the debt? It doesn't mean any sense to me.
So whatever makes it that you monetize.
They have surpluses.
It's just
why weren't they increasing the money supply? That's my
operation. It's money. It's demand. The fixed exchange rate and the money. You're in a gold standard.
So they were having inflation.
We have to understand that, but it's easier to see the mechanical how you would do it. I mean, the question is why people are holding the money.
No, but if you fix the exchange rate, you have some reserves. Then you're going to print money because they bring you the reserves for you to print the money. So that should be creating the inflation. To me, the puzzle is not so much why the real succeed, it's why the previous one failed. When I see those fiscal numbers.
To go back to the one in Argentina. You fix the nominal exchange rate, you promise that you will do the same, you promise that everything else will happen, then people start saying that other problems are coming later on, then they go and they have like a standard looking balance of payment attack. Even in the balance of payment attack, it takes time. Because you fix the nominal exchange rate, I mean, the standard logic of the balance of payment attack.
But the standard logic of the balance of payment attack is that you're financing the deficit. Improvement model, you're financing the deficit.
So it's whatever it is in the future. So improvement model is totally static. But whatever is in the future that you didn't change, so you are.
Okay.
So one question about what between 1994 is whether there were like debt payments coming due that Brazil could not roll over or something like that. That would explain why it put this group.
That would.
Yeah. But I don't know if that's the case.
But I think at that time we were in default.
Yeah, but sometimes in default you're still paying something. Maybe that's what they do.
Yeah.
This shouldn't show what the deficit figures or what?
No. So it's not a deficit.
It's capital. It's payments of capital.
You have to pay principal back on your debt. Nobody's lending you, and you just pay money to pay that back. That's what Argentina is doing now.
So starting late 91, we raised interest rates and then start accumulating foreign reserves. So that's one of the things that made possible the offset. They had reserves while the other people didn't have any.
And we use it to see what the central bank balance sheet. It would be useful to look at the central bank balance sheet and see what the assets and liabilities are. I would then tell you. I mean, my answer to you is it's only mostly fiscal. It's not all fiscal.
I don't understand.
People say the IMF stands for it's mostly fiscal. It's not always fiscal. So this is a case where it wasn't fiscal. That's your answer, right? It's something else. Probably in the central bank balance sheet.
So what do you mean, that they make it bad?
But it might be something like your explanation, but it's all in the central bank balance sheet.
No, but what do you mean, like, that they like have an asset that they made money? I mean, like,
So a stark way of saying what you guys, the so spectacular way of saying the result is it's all contemporaneous, and there's a demand function for money, and there's no interest elasticity. So expectations in the future and stuff don't matter, because that's the route. So if you take the Marcet Michelini model, which basically, it's very simple. It's got a government budget constraint, and in their model, that entire deficit's monetized. That's equation one. Second equation is it's a KM like demand function for money, but there's an elasticity. And the third thing is there's a, God forbid, adaptive expectations, kind of modern adaptive expectations where guys are fitting something by these squares. If you put those together, and there's a lack of them, and their whole story is stuff about whether there's two fixed points in the lack of them, and one's quote unquote stable, and one's unstable. And the reason that you adaptive expectations is because the rational expectation dynamics are screwy. The adaptive expectation dynamics are sensible. But there's a possibility of getting on a region in which the dynamics just force you into outer space. So you get an expect, you get a bubble. I can't say this in this word. There's a bubble. It's divorced from fundamentals. You're just driving up. And the only way you can stop that in a couple ways. But one way they got stopped is the bowling. What I want to say is the shape of that laughter curve is influenced by the demand function for money. It's influenced by the elasticity of demand function for money. That's a key parameter. And if you kind of estimate that thing on Brazilian data, you don't get this. Well, kind of two outcomes. One is you don't get this interest in elastic demand function. You get interest elasticity, and you need it to activate their story. And their story tells you. Their story helps you understand why that the at first at least the real plan was a cosmetic thing, and only later did it kind of fits that. So you're kind of a maximum likelihood guy, and you take their thing.
We did some experiments with interesting elastic demand for money, both the semi, the cadence semi-log, and others that where you don't get
so
the level curve.
But what are you fitting into? See, the inside of their paper is the hunch of their paper is that the probably the best data are the inflation data. They're going to go after those, and then you start mentioning more data, and they're more crackly measured. So the question is, if you approach the data as written by errors, say that just the inflation data have some evidence about this. It's just another way of looking.
I don't want to play devil's advocate, but this thing that they need to have any result, and it's something like going back to the gold standard, something that for sure will bring you back.
So there's,
I guess in the sample, it's hard to think about what it is.
Okay, the beauty of their thing is you can be silent about it. You can say something brought you back. And it's like a hidden, like what I said, a hidden Markov state. And you can extract something. And then you could also differentiate between when it's that and something really doesn't matter. So there's, they have a structure. These hidden Markov models are a little bit agile because you there's stuff you don't see, but you see its shadows. So.
What would be an example of something that would bring you about?
They have stories, and it's like Marcio's list. He had a whole bunch of he had a big long list of stuff. Are you going to grab expectations and push it back?
But I thought that's the whole discussion. I thought the discussion is that it's not obvious that you see one of the things coming back. But the narrative. Because I thought there had to be something
every time they see one, you can ex post construct a narrative.
Yeah.
Well, like this is the time, in 86, and it matches that. This is the time in 86 where the guy said, I'm going to freeze prices. Sorry.
One of the things that brings the invitation back, don't write an op-ed.
So Tom, one of the things we are doing, maybe this is a very great suggestion just gave, because with this reverse Libera-Tanzi effect, instead of having a horizontal where the deficit is, because of the erosion that inflation has on taxes, this this thing slopes downwards. So we have other possibilities showing up there.